Today is January 31st, 2015, the day before Super Bowl. And this is Mobile Views Podcast number 108. John Westfall and I'm Taro Gasawar, here with my special guest, Emil Reyes, who's going to be talking with us about 3D printing design. But first, John and I, maybe Emil can jump in too. I just wanted to mention a couple of things. I finally restored functionality to my Dell Venue 8 Pro, which has been more or less dead since November, when Windows 10 Technical Preview 1 managed to trash my configuration. I was too lazy to try to fix it. I finally got around to fixing it just before, or is it just after? But just around the time Windows 10 Technical Preview 2 was released, about, a week and a half ago. So I restored it. I've got Windows 10 Technical Preview 2, build 9926 installed. I had to install Dell's Wi-Fi and Bluetooth driver to get communications back because it was completely isolated from the world after the upgrade. And I want to say hello to the Start menu. Welcome back, Start menu. I missed you a lot. goodbye, Charms. I hated Charms, so that's nice. And welcome to the Action Center, which replaces Charms if you swipe in from the right on a touch screen. Couple of things. The new Start menu can expand to a full window when you're in tablet mode. Some people hate this, by the way. I'm not quite sure why they hate it, but I like it. So my Venue 8 Pro is a tablet. Sometimes I use it with a Bluetooth keyboard, and I can shrink that Start menu down to kind of a one-third, half-screen maybe, but still has widgets and things, so that's kind of neat. But it's not quite as functional as the widgets on Android, not quite as much information, I think. And, oh, I also want to say goodbye to Metro. That appears to be gone. That's the tiled interface that came from the Windows Phone world. Metro apps are now windowed on the desktop, which I like a lot, because it seemed to be silly to have something called Microsoft Windows that only had one window. and the final Microsoft, thing I want...
Just was, Microsoft Window. Yeah, that was going to be the evolution of Windows.
Right, drop the S.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, it's like Windows Phone. They're making the P lowercase instead of capital, so you know, drop the S.
Well, of course they are. Microsoft and their infinite branding wisdom knows exactly how to confuse and bewilder users from end to end.
Speaking of bewildering, Cortana made it her, I guess we can call it her, her entry into the desktop with Windows 10 Technical Preview 2, and it is, well, it's a beta, so, but given that, it's disappointing if you've used Google Now or Apple Siri. It tends to fail a lot, doesn't respond in a way I kind of expect now after using Google Now and Apple Siri. So, you know, it's still, beta 2, so we'll see what's going to go on.
Now, Todd, do you have any Windows Phone devices over there that run Cortana?
No, I haven't had a
Windows. Have you ever played with any?
No.
I know that we've been hearing how great Cortana is from some of our mutual friends, and so I'm curious about how Cortana on Tech Preview 2 compares to Cortana on the phone, because I would assume they're both using the back end of whatever Cortana uses. But I'm curious where the shortcomings are. What specifically can you do with Google Now or Siri that Cortana was failing on?
Well, it's not so much fail. It just doesn't do it in a lot as well. So, for example, if I ask Siri or I ask Google Now using my voice, say okay Google in the Chrome browser, it will speak that answer back to me. Cortana will do one and sometimes two things. One, it often fails, so it doesn't even know what the weather is. Or two, if it does figure out what the weather is, it simply displays it on the screen, so it doesn't talk to me. Now, given that it's desktop, maybe that's not as important as on a phone, where you know you may have to be eyes-free as well as hands-free. In other words, not looking at the screen. But it seems to me that it should be doing this correctly. So, for example, OK Google in Chrome browser on the desktop will speak to me if I say, you know, weather Honolulu, Hawaii, or something like that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'll be curious to see, hopefully, some of our friends that are heavy Windows Phone users and heavy tech preview people can kind of compare Cortana and give us an unbiased or somewhat unbiased evaluation of Cortana. Both platforms are the same, and then also is it really inferior to Google Now or Siri? Because that surprises me that you... Because I've heard nothing but praise for Cortana. I haven't spoken with Cortana personally.
I was very unpleasantly surprised when I learned how not learned, but when it seemed to me that Cortana was so limited on the desktop compared to what, like you, what I'd heard, you know, glowing reviews. Oh, Cortana knows this and that, and it knows more about my information and all that. Even though Microsoft says that Cortana has more privacy settings than Google Now and Apple Siri. But we'll see. As I said, it's a preview. It's still a beta, so I'm willing to cut it some slack, and we'll wait to see what it finally ends up as. I still haven't played with Windows 10 Technical Preview 2 to really get a sense for much more than that. But I will say this. I like it a lot. I even like Technical Preview 1 until it killed my tablet. I even like Technical Preview 1 a lot better than Windows 8. To me, Windows 8 is the Windows ME of the 21st century. it was just a disaster all the way around. So at least, you know, if you don't have a touchscreen, Windows 10 is now usable, I think, or at least more usable. If you do have a touchscreen, it is as usable as it was. It's still got some problems, like the fact that they still don't have really apps that are touchable, especially on small screen devices like the Dell Venue 8 Pro, which only has an 8-inch screen. On the 10-inch screen, like on the Asus I have, it's a little bit more usable. But it's hard to touch stuff on that, even for apps that are designed for touch. And, of course, there's still no Office, touch-first Office, so that'll be kind of interesting. Speaking of Office, though, and other stuff, if you have an Android tablet, Microsoft Word, Excel, and PowerPoint for Android left the preview phase earlier this week, and you can now download more or less fully functional apps. Still, I don't know exactly what they're missing compared to the desktop. On iOS, they're pretty good. I can see edits and review mode rather, that sort of thing. So I like it a lot. The other thing was kind of interesting for Microsoft is they released Microsoft Outlook for iOS and Android. I installed it on my iPhone and it's kind of interesting. But then, naturally, right after I read it, I also read another article. I think it was on ZDNet, saying that Microsoft actually stores all of your login info for other services, including Yahoo and Google, in the cloud. So it becomes a security risk. So thank you, Microsoft, for that. Mm-hmm. And what were you going to say, Emil?
No, yeah, that I agree. That's definitely more risky.
Yeah. So, I've already done it. So now, naturally, I did it before I read that article.
Yeah, and that – so I'm kind of looking at the screenshots. I haven't installed Outlook yet on my phone because, with the iPhone, I feel like I get kind of as much as I need out of my Exchange server at work that I can, I have my Exchange mailbox, I have my global address book and all of that. But I'm thinking, with especially things like Google Drive and Dropbox, those, if you have two-factor authentication turned on and Microsoft decides to just store not the credentials, because it can't do that, but the OAuth tokens that it gets, you've destroyed the security of two-factor because presumably that token, if you told it to save that device, that token will work regardless. So this is a really poor design choice by Microsoft that will cause people who have taken appropriate precautions, they've done all the, the strong password, the two-factor, all of that, they basically, if Microsoft's secure store is ever hacked, their tokens are in jeopardy.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, it's a nice app, by the way. It's almost too bad it doesn't do IMAP 4, because then I could really move everything to it. But, given this, what I learned, I guess I wouldn't do it now. And those of you who haven't tried Microsoft Outlook might want to consider that before you go to it, especially if you are going to connect to an Exchange server at work and possibly get a lot of IT sysadmin types upset at you.
Yeah, and also if you would like to have access to your Exchange mailbox but not have Exchange security policies apply to your personal device.
Yeah, right. Good point.
So you can do it through the Outlook app and then do whatever you want on your personal device.
Yeah. Yeah. And the final thing I wanted to mention is something I haven't been able to try yet, and that is that Google has made Google Earth Pro free, which is kind of interesting. And I say I haven't tried it yet because I tried to – you have to kind of log in and, get authorized to use it. You can download it. I don't know what happens after you authorize it. But anyway, I tried to sign in and all that and said, we can't do it now, so try again later. So I'll try later. And I think Google Earth Pro used to be about, $299, $399? So, from a couple hundred bucks to free is a good deal.
That is. And it's if anything, Google Earth has always been a fun product, and the Pro features will just add, if you enjoy kind of playing around with it, the planning features and all that, I'm sure will cause you a little bit more fun, if nothing else.
And also higher resolution aerial views.
Yep.
So there's that. Okay, now let's get to the main part of this episode, and that's my guest, Emil Reyes. And I asked Emil and I used to work together many moons ago, and Emil has a lot of skill sets, but the one I asked him to talk about today is his background in 3D printing and design. So Emil, can you give us a brief background on what you were involved with and are involved with in 3D printing and design, so folks know a little bit about you?
I started out with 3D printing in 2005. And that was with, at that time, it was a company called Z Corporation. They had the first color 3D printer. I was introduced to 3D printing when I worked for one of the Army's Battle Space Labs back in 99. And then in 2005, decided it was time to hop in. Purchased my first printer at around 2007, I'll say. And being that because in 2006, 2007... the entry level printer cost was around $20,000. So got the friends and help with friends and family, got it started, worked as a sales and service provider for these, and these were mainly targeting large schools and manufacturing companies. Back then, especially in Honolulu, Hawaii, 3D printing wasn't something that was fairly unbelievable. Not many people knew about it or even believed it worked. I had my own company doing 3D printing and design services. Learned a lot about design services because always thought that always knew that 3D printing was going to start to spread out to the masses, almost to the same level, comparably to the inkjet printing or professional 2D printing market. And it's getting there. It still has some ways to go, but it's getting there. After Z Corporation got purchased by 3D Systems, I became an authorized 3D Systems dealer and maintenance provider. Worked a little bit with their competitor, Stratasys. Now I'm working with a company called Cell out of the UK. The reason I'm working with them is because they have the potential to be one of the first very low cost, meaning under $1,500, FDM, fixed deposition modeling printer. I'm sorry, fused deposition modeling printer. For under $1,500, and I'm looking more at 3D printing being originally working at it for something in institutions and larger companies. Now I'm definitely being focused more on getting it onto the desktop and into the home market.
Yeah.
So I think that I think it's not there yet. There's a lot of people who will tell you, oh yeah, 3D printing, yeah, it's there. We can use it. And they're right, but there's still a very large investment, personal time, and $1,500 for the home market is still a healthy investment if it's not plug and play.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you about that. I'm glad you mentioned that price, $1,500, because I think I remember when I bought my first laser jet printer for my home, mm-hmm. and that must have been around 1990. Something, let's say 1991, 92. I think it was a LaserJet 4, and I paid about $1,500 for it at Costco. Mm-hmm. And you're right, it is a lot of money. It was a lot more money back then, when you account for inflation. But it is a lot of money, but it is an amount that a person can at least consider spending. $20,000 for a printer. Mm-hmm. And laser printers, the linotypes and things like that used to be much more. And those are unaffordable for your home. But at $1,500, well, it's a lot of money, but I could kind of justify it. And I think that's kind of where we are with the consumer 3D printers. I wanted to hear your take on it. You've got a depth and breadth of knowledge of these things. So kind of think back 5 years ago to where we were, where there were no consumer 3D printers. It was all commercial, in 2010, let's say. Fast forward to today, 2015, 5 years later, I don't know if it's out yet, but the HP multi-jet fusion printer that can do multiple materials in single passes, either soon to be out or is out. We have, I don't know what it's going to cost, and we do have consumer printer, 3D printers at about $1,500, maybe a little less, somewhere under $1,000. What do you get for that kind of money these days compared to, you know, the high-end stuff?
I would say it's good and bad. If you're a tinkerer, it's great. It's outstanding because, you know, people who really like to tinker like to get into things. They like to be able to alter their own settings. They like, you know, they don't want the friendly GUI that you can't see behind.
Mm-hmm.
And for a tinkerer, it's a lot of fun. But, I'm looking at it, this way is imagine that laser printer you bought. If you hit print, the results weren't acceptable. Okay, mm-hmm. You hit print not every time. And then you had to think about, okay, am I using the right ink? Is the ink right? What are my humidity levels like in the room? Is the paper correct? And that's still, if you're looking at the lower cost printers, it's still there. There's things like, you know, when you buy a low cost printer, things you have to worry about. I call it, print and pray to make, because what's the most unfortunate thing when I talk to hobby level users, and that's in the 3D professional printing realm, mostly a lot of these low cost FDMs are considered hobby level because you can get a good result. But there's, you know, professional result, meaning, and professional doesn't mean it looks good. Professional means it's predictable,
mm-hmm.
meaning that, you know, my edges are going to look like edges, and that when I ask for 16 microns of accuracy, I'm going to get 16 microns of accuracy. That's what professional means. A lot of people think, oh, it looks smooth. It looks pretty. It's not always that. It's when I'm engineering a piece, is it going to be to the accuracy I design it at, mm-hmm. consistent? So you get a mixed bag, and you have to really know, in my opinion, you really need to know, you really want to know when you're shopping for a low-cost 3D printer, what are the sacrifices? Because now FDM, where it's melted plastic in layers, was the first to really hit the consumer-level market because of expired patents. Now we have some other ones. We have now some powder-level printers. The first $5,000, which is amazing. There's a $5,000 selective laser sintering printer that does metal now.
Wow.
It's out. Or I guess it's ready for. It's going to be ready for release this year. And the cheapest SLS machine prior to that, I believe was around $150,000. So, and that's really the big thing that, I caution people to really research and understand what they're buying before they get a 3D printer. Otherwise, you will have buyer's remorse when that thing sits there and you don't know what's wrong with it. Mm. Think about this. When I had my full company doing 3D printing, we bought, we had a printer that was $80,000. Okay. And it was pretty high quality. And then within the whole product spectrum, the lowest cost 3D printing you could get at one time was $30,000. Within 1 year, it dropped to $5,000.
Wow.
So so it changed the market considerably, just that one patent expiring for FDM.
Mm-hmm.
Considerably. With more patents expiring, you know, now companies are making, like the HP printer, why it's not out yet, I believe they might be waiting for a patent to expire.
Oh, really?
That might be it. It's prepping the market. They finished everything already. They obviously, it looks a lot like the original Z-Core powder material, which is owned by 3D Systems now. But that's the one a lot of people are waiting to. It's a powder and rake patent. As soon as that expires, you're going to see a lot of people. I mean, nowadays it's less than a year from patent expiration to implementation.
Wow. So what's the difference when, for these materials that you put into the printer? You're talking about powder and what was the other one, the one that earlier?
There's a few of them. There's a plastic base, which is what do you call it, the thin wire. That's FDM. You have resin based materials, which is photocured or ink or photocured, and they're distributed either at a layer, and it's stereolithography where the layer is fused layer upon layer, or with the inkjets now you have them deposited with an inkjet with the with the light shining as it's printing, one of the one that HP is looking at is where it's basically a binder or a glue,
mm-hmm.
is in a layer of powder, and then it's stacked on top of each other powder by powder. The interesting thing now is the filament FDM is, you know, this year I'd say the main advancement from CES was really better materials, different materials. And a lot, since things have gone more mainstream and more open source, materials is where we have things where typically someone like one of the larger companies who have the patents for 3D printing, they would only focus on developing materials that fit their commercial need. Oh. You know, if everybody needs nylon, they're focusing on developing nylon materials. Oh. But now we have people who are making wood-based materials, people who are making rubber-like materials. I remember when I worked with 3D Systems, they announced, oh, we're getting rid of our rubber-based line, a rubber-like line. You know, and now we have people using FDM with rubber-like materials. So that's very hopeful that from these independents that we're getting new advancements that we wouldn't have seen otherwise.
So when you say like wood-based material, you're talking about literally printing something that is either based on cellulose or something that looks like wood or is wood?
It's a mix like a wood core and plastic, and you know
to stick it together.
And it's in a filament, and they even have brass now, and they have I can't remember they have rubber like, and they use the FDM process because it's the lowest cost process right now, and it comes out with a wood like finish or the wood does, and you know so it has different properties. I've actually seen some magnetic material too. So it does really alter. If you're creative, it really does alter what you can do. And what's nice is if I haven't actually seen the wood-based material, I've seen samples of it online. I've read the specs of it. I know a couple of companies that are looking to use it more regularly. I know that MakerBot I just released, I think it was wood-based and some other different core materials. But yeah, it's very interesting stuff.
So I have a quick question as someone who hasn't gotten too much into this world and obviously is interested in it, but you make an observation that, you know, this is going to get big in the consumer market, and I don't doubt it will. I'm just curious for people who are listening and going, okay, I understand where 3D printing would be for a hobbyist or an enthusiast. What is the public going to see in 10 years when they – buy a 3D printer, what are their primary uses going to be for it?
I like to think that it's one of those things that I can buy a soldering iron, but it doesn't mean I'm going to make electronics. And that's the concern I think that people are answering different ways, and it's coming more from the independents rather than the companies. You know, I will say that the one thing that I'm really happy about is seeing the 3D CAD software development has changed drastically. I was playing with, I'll mention Automaker 123D, and I was noticing some of their features are something they used to reserve for the higher level packages, but this is free. Mm-hmm. You know, hollowing to an exact measurement is something that was typically, you know, honestly, in some package, it was $10,000.
Wow.
Just to be able to get features like that. Now you can get them for free. And that's a huge deal for someone who makes something or understands what it is for software. Most people who, you know, people who do art like Maya don't understand the importance of solid of accurate hollowing for solid modeling. So that's very exciting. But you're right. The thing is, I think in the future, getting back to your question, how I see it is, say, my mom and dad, they're not going to learn 3D printing. They're not going to learn CAD. There's no way that my dad's going to sit down and learn CAD at his age and his interest level. But I think if I get him a 3D printer, and eventually, instead of going out to Walmart to buy certain things, if he can just make them at home, he's definitely going to want to do that.
Uh-huh.
And for those things that to happen, you're going to need a little, or you're going to have licensing issues. You're going to have better online organization. Like Thingiverse is huge, but the one thing I've noticed, it doesn't exactly talk about, you know, price for printing. Mm. It just puts the files out there. And if you understand the printer you have, then you can do it at an affordable rate. If I have, say a really reliable printer versus a not so reliable printer, I can make a price point, and that's the professional knowledge of it. But if I have to print that thing five times because my printer's not you know, I'm not good at it. I've just lost my price point. So when that knowledge is, you know, is made easy for the consumer, right now the term that they're using is prosumer. Mm-hmm. You know, people like you and me who are into technology can figure this out. To the point where if I see something online that I'd rather print than buy, I can do it affordably. But, you know, otherwise, if I just buy a printer, you real quick, if I don't have the knowledge, then I'll realize, wow, I'm spending a lot of money.
Hmm. Yep.
And then you'll have your buyer's remorse.
Yeah, so this is interesting. So we're on that development curve that we've seen so often. You know, in the old days, in the early part of the 20th century, if you wanted to drive a car, you had better be a mechanic. You know, there is no other way you could keep that car running. And similarly, in the early days of personal computing, you didn't need to be an engineer necessarily, but you had to be a, you know, at least an amateur technologist, somebody who could pop in ICs, you know, integrated circuits, and, you know, wasn't afraid to solder in a few things and could at least, you know, pull RAM in and out of a computer to get things done. Nobody does that anymore. In fact, you can't even get inside of a computer.
Yeah.
Even with, you know, early printers, we, you know, you guys might not be old enough to remember, but when the first laser printers came out, we used to scratch our heads a lot about kerning and monospace printing and, you know, typefaces and what they're going to look like and whether we should write justify, you know, fully justify or ragged justify. And we, things that are kind of common knowledge now, at least for most people, were things we just used to scratch our heads over and we couldn't figure out. We had to figure out, I guess. And where do you think we are now, Emil, in that kind of curve? You know, what do you need to know? What does a person need to know as a consumer level? Not even a prosumer, as a consumer. What does that person need to know to successfully use a low-end, you know, under $1,500 printer?
Well, the thing to understand, first of all, I've always said this ever since I started, the first thing I learned is 3D printing is never instant. It's not instant, no matter how long you think it is, because your brain, you have to train it basically to think in 3D. So I can make a 3D model. When I print it out, I might be, what the heck is this? This is not what I expected. And I think, you know, and I'm someone who's grown up with 3D. You know, there are people who really have trouble. You know, it's funny. I was working with an engineer. And I gave him a 3D model. He's like, no, I need the 2D layout.
Mm.
And I was like, but you have the 3D model. He said,
yeah,
but I think in 2D, I need the 2D layout. I'm like, okay, no problem. And there's a lot of people who are classically trained that way. And it's going to be that way for a while because people think in 2D. It's very natural. It's for a lot of people, it's more natural than 3D. As far as the printers go, in my opinion, we're getting there. We're not there yet. I'd say we're still... even with the new patents expiring, I think we're a good at least 2 or 3 years, depending if more advancements goes to where it's at the point where it's just hit print and forget about it.
Because
the biggest drawback right now that deters people is, you know, and this is the same thing I get from selling printers and to talking to people about printers, the 3D printers, is that when I tell people, well, I make this little model, it's about yay big, it's about as big as my fist, you know, so I can print it off, I can hit print and I'll get it. And the thing that I tell them is, yeah, in about 8 hours. And then they look at me and they're like, what?
8 hours? I thought you could do it in 2 minutes.
And then a lot of people have the sci-fi notion, they think it's like Star Trek, and they say, okay, well, I can start my own business. I can just start making these things. And they don't take into account that, look, you know, that things are still, you know, 3D printing is an accelerator. It's not a final means. We use it to make molds. That's a good thing because then you mass produce with the molds. But, you know, I was just talking to somebody who's looking at it, and they did what we tried to do in Hawaii, is look at ways for sustainment for certain industries. And it's not there yet. It's just not there. You don't mass produce with a 3D printer. It's just not. It's, you know, you can mass produce what's called high volume, low volume, high value, but we're talking about things like medical implants and airplane parts, and the initial investment for a machine being around $1 million. So you know, right now, I'm you know, we're at what I call the Chotsky level, where you can make things that are personalized, you can make things that are customized and suitable to your purpose, but there's that large level skill set. Yeah. Okay. There's online catalogs where you can just download something and print it, but it's not like, you know, we've separate, it's not like we've gotten where there's a Windows and a Mac, where you see a model, you want to print it, and you go, okay, is it Windows or it's a Mac compatible? It's not, you know, it's not at that level where you go and look at an app store. Right now, if someone puts a model online, you have to review it to see if it'll print in your printer. Hmm. And if you don't, and if you don't know what you know, the detail of what your printer does, you know, it's it, you know, again, it's beyond the point where people like my parents can just grab a printer and print something. Mm-hmm. So, but it's definitely much easier than when I started. Much easier. So I see it going in the right direction. There's a lot of focus now on the user experience. Like I said, the one printer I'm working with eliminates probably about 50 to 70% of the work, from bed leveling to understanding material properties. And that's when you get down to the lower level printers, if you're just running something that's known and you know the settings for your materials, like when you're doing FDM, knowing what material its melting point, you know, how it spreads and everything and how it cools, that makes a huge difference. And would, I mean, when you start messing with these level printers, you can run for hours just trying to figure out the right settings for materials.
Yeah. Now, so, earlier you mentioned, you know, you're talking about worrying about things that most of us, well, actually, we used to have to think about things like humidity and stuff, even in regular printers. Yeah. In the old days, because your paper would curl if it's a little too humid. So, you know, for people who, especially, well, for people like me in Hawaii, where, you know, most of the time our windows are open, we never have a heater on. Well, I guess most of us don't have a heater on. Some people have air conditioning, but most of us just ambient temperature. Do we have to worry about things like, you know, high humidity and, you know, temperatures fluctuating maybe 5, 10 degrees, that sort of thing?
Humidity right now with the FDM printers, with the melted plastic printers, they love heat. Not so much. And you can control it to a certain amount. You would have to worry about, even with plastic filament, if water seeps into it, it can retain water and cause bubbling. Mm. So, yeah, there are some worries. With powder printers, when I had the powder printers in my office, you definitely had to worry about humidity. We kept we tried to keep so as best as we could as humidity control, but we were above a pool, if you remember.
Yeah.
Didn't do much. Because with powder printers, you get humidity and sticking, and it alters the some of the powders are made to absorb the binder material. So when it's high humidity, it causes a lot of problems. So you do need to understand that, because it's one of the, that's probably one of the, as you know, with the 2D printers, that's one of the hardest things to control is environment. So when you get again on the 3D level, there's more things to control. It can become a great concern.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it really sounds like if even at the consumer, amateur, you know, hobbyist level, you really gotta know a lot more about what's going into the printer, how it's coming out, what the ambience, the ambient environment is like, the design. It's a lot of stuff to think about.
Yeah, it's, you know, and that's part of to me, that's some of the fun things. You know, it's like a mechanic in his car. You know, you look into that, and that's your hobby. It's what you like doing it. And that's where 3D printers are selling right now. That's one of the reasons why, you know, we've known that you can buy them, you know, at, I don't know about Walmart, but I know, I think, I can't remember, Office Max said they were selling them. But they're not like on the shelf from what I see. Mm. You know, there's still something you can order online, because you still have to do a lot of tinkering.
Yeah,
So, you know, the day when it's just, you know, and the big names know it too. 3D Systems advertises their low-level printers and prosumer-level printers. And when you do your research, you see, if I buy basically the lower cost it is, the more tinkering and the more knowledge I'll have to know or learn when I pick it up.
Yeah. Okay. So two last questions. One, if a person was, you know, having heard all of these issues you need to deal with to get started 3D printing, if you have, let's say, $1,000 to $1,500 burning your pocket to buy a consumer level, hobbyist level printer, which two or three models would you start looking at?
That's hard because there's new printers coming out every day.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would look at is build quality. I say the better thing is looking at what to look for a $1,500 printer.
Mm-hmm.
I would say build quality. If you can get a larger size, try to pay attention to what it is you're printing. If you're someone who's printing big level things, if you're a costume guy, then you want a big build size. If you're an engineer who's making parts, typically smaller will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Reason being, because desk space is a big issue. But build quality, is it made from 3D printed parts or milled parts? Reason being is because vibration and quality of parts can make a big difference. Okay, the bigger the printer is, the more solid and stable it needs to be. I used to wonder why the 3D printers that we had that were big as refrigerators weighed about 600 pounds. There's a reason why they were built big and heavy, is because it limits vibration and keeps things from going off kilter.
Mm.
So these little ones that are made out of 3D printed parts and basically just really cheap made rails, you'll spend more time with them.
That's interesting. Many, many years ago, back when I was doing things in optics, mm-hmm. We had to make sure our optical benches were on literally rock solid yeah. platforms. Mm-hmm. Because in California, we used to have tremors and all kinds of stuff all the time, and just the littlest vibration would throw your whole optical bench out of alignment. So sounds kind of similar.
It's a huge disappointment when you set to print, then it's going to take 15 hours, and at 14.5 hours, it throws off.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a huge discouragement, because you're talking about material, a lot of material, you're talking about time, and now you've got to go back and troubleshoot and figure out what's wrong with your printer. So
wow.
It's that's the thing. But looking for a rock solid build, I always, a lot of people always ask me about a new printer that they saw on Kickstarter. I would say give it a year. Wait. Mm. I hate to say that. Buy something that's a little more a beginner or that has reputation that you know about.
Mm-hmm.
The criteria I used to get into the Sell Robox was, one, it was by a company that had successful commercial devices already out. The company Sell has done home workbench type equipment. And then also looking at the build quality and understanding the software. Software is another big point. A lot of the low-level printers will come with, here's a software kit.
Mm-hmm.
You have licenses and that's it. If you're a beginner and you're buying stuff, you want to look for an integrated package if you don't want to spend too much time learning that, okay, I have to model it, then I have to slice it, and then I have to run it through the software package. Okay? Yeah. Whereas professional printers will have one software package, that's it. A lot of the lower cost ones will just say, here, use the open source stuff, and then you've got to make sure it all works together.
Mm.
So if you're not that type of person, that's definitely something you should pay attention to. Yeah. is the software package.
Yeah, in fact, that was my second question, what kind of software to look for. So, kind of taking us through real quickly, if we had a design, let's say we don't want to design something. We just saw something on Thingiverse or something. Mm-hmm. And said, oh, that's kind of cool, cube or something, like the ones that you showed me early on.
Yeah.
So you download the 3D design, and then what happens? What kind of package do you need? What kind of software do you need to view it? And then how do you get that to the printer?
Viewing it, there's a number of viewers you can do. But like if you buy a 3D printer, there's some interface. If they're just doing straight, I think it's G-code. It basically is taking from one of the most common. You would get the model online, and I'm going to say it's just a regular stereolithography format, which is the most common format. And then from there, you'd have to slice it. Okay, professional packages, they do it all in one. If you don't have that, you would get there's a software called Slicer that's free. You would get that. And then that would go to G-code, and then that would send it, and then your printer would read it in G-code. If you have a more finished software package, the great ones will just take your Automaker by Sell. It actually incorporates Slicer, but it takes it. All you do is you hit print, and it's automatically you'll actually see it send it to Slicer and send it to the printer for you. Okay. There's other people where other software I've seen where there's other packages I've seen where you have to slice it yourself and then you send it to the printer yourself after you send your slicer.
This sounds like being a programmer back in the 1980s or early 1990s where you had to have a first you have a you compile it, then you link edit, and then you turn it into executable. And
What's weird is starting at the pro level, and this is I have a very high standard for 3D printing now because working with the pro level stuff, it's great. You just take the model, you don't worry about anything. It slices it for you. It can tell you if there's an error in certain instances, and pretty much it's you're on your own from what I see in a lot of the hobby level stuff. When I've talked to people who've used different 3D printers and even the ones I'm using now that are more hobby level, if you look at forums, there's tons of hints and tips on how to do this stuff. And when I started, I was like, I didn't do that. I just sent it to my printer. So it's kind of it's definitely paying attention to how whoever's making the printer, if they're making it more as an open source platform or something that's more of a finished product.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have one more question before we finish up this 3D printing conversation. Well, how do you set expectations for yourself as a consumer? So, for example, I remember back when you were still here in Honolulu, you were doing something for a customer where it was like a full-size motorcycle helmet, a custom helmet.
Uh-huh.
And is that something way beyond what you should expect from a consumer-grade 3D printer, or is that something, if you're very patient, you could actually cobble it together?
No, you can do that, and they're doing it now for cosplay. It's still a lot of work, but it takes the majority of the design process. It shortens it down, and if you have the skill to turn that material into something that looks good, it's still definitely viable. Mm. You can get large format printers are at least like 8x11x12 inch build platforms for under $5,000 now. So people with design skills can produce some very nice things, but there's always finishing work to consider. To get that one helmet, if you're using lower end software, if you're not too familiar with your software, you could be printing three iterations till you get what you want.
Hmm.
So if you're willing to put in the time and sacrifice some plastic for it, then yeah, it is possible nowadays, and it's impressive some of the results I've seen. I'm seeing pretty large stuff that being produced by people out of nowhere, whereas in the past you definitely needed to be somebody with some training.
Yeah, I did see. I don't know what kind of equipment this person had, but I remember seeing online some guy produced a full Batman outfit. Like in the movies, kind of Batman outfit.
Yeah, it's possible.
And it was pretty darn impressive.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I, again, don't know if he had like a professional printer or just a very patient consumer level printer.
He probably used a hobby level printer. Yeah. I saw some of it and I looked at the surface and I was thinking to myself, he did a good job printing it. He could have done a little bit of a better job finishing it, but it's definitely a wonderful job is definitely what he did.
Yeah.
So those things that you're looking at, just being critical, I think I'm just being critical,
too much, Emil.
A little bit of skill, you can do things that you couldn't do before, which is what I'm really happy about.
Nice. Hey, Emil, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us. We got one more thing. I think John has an app pick before we sign off. John?
Yeah, one of the apps. My app pick of the week is something I came across this morning. It's one of Apple's editor picked apps. It's a free app called Memoir. Memoir is, if you've seen people who have these little Facebook apps that say, 2 years ago or 3 years ago or whatever, Memoir does that, but without having to hook it up. Well, you hook it up to Facebook if you wanted to use Facebook sources, but you don't have to post to Facebook or log into Facebook to view your memoirs from a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that sort of thing. So you can hook it up to your Twitter, your Facebook account. I think it also supports Instagram and a few other services. And there are some mixed reviews. There's a macOS client for it that doesn't seem to do a whole lot right now. The iOS client looks pretty slick. My only wish for it would be that it would support exporting, but I don't quite see that yet. But it's something to watch, and the price is right. It's free. So if you're looking for a way to kind of tap into what you were doing 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I know that, for example, 2 years ago, I posted a couple of things on Twitter that I'm kind of laughing about now, forgetting that that was, you know, 2 years ago, or forgetting that that even happened. So it's kind of a nice way to look back and say, oh, that's what happened in my life that I didn't bother to write down that day, but did bother to broadcast all over social media. So that's my app pick of the week, is Memoir. It is free on both iOS and macOS.
Okay, I'll take a look at that. That's actually kind of interesting, because Facebook is kind of doing those lookbacks now automatically. But it'd be nice to see other media I may have posted elsewhere.
Yeah, and there's that, I forget what the name of the app is on Facebook that people post all the time, where, you know, 5 years ago, six years ago. But I've never really liked the idea of that app because, A, I don't think I'd ever post any, to really point out. I'm just not that kind of person that likes to wax philosophical or memorial or whatever about 10 years ago. But I am one of those persons that want to see it.
Let you get older. See it.
Well, you know, Todd, you were talking earlier about typesetting, and I was thinking I should really call my father, since he had a $25,000 CompU graphics computer in the 70s and a giant stat camera and a Fuser printer unit for the CompU graphics. So I understand that struggle, because I grew up with someone who did that, who would look at what I would help him create using WordPerfect and get very annoyed that using his font template, templates and using his spacers and everything, it wasn't exactly the way he wanted it laid out. And so it'd be, okay, I'll print it again, or I'll move it over, you know, what looks to be 2 points, and we'll see if that works better, etc. That's my dad's background in advertising. I guess it was a good thing he went into sales eventually.
Okay.
Those were giving us all nuts.
Okay, so this is Mobile Views Podcast number 108. John Westfall and I had our special guest Emil Reyes talking about 3D printing and design. Thanks again, Emil, and we'll talk again next time.